but evolutionary biologists have since found four more examples of gene swapping between other parasitic plants and their hosts. Biologists are now rethinking whether this sort of gene transfer might play a bigger role in plant evolution than previously thought. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the American Society of Plant Biologists. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Aaron Richardson at the University of Georgia. I'm Don Glass.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 2:41, 82 degrees in Urbana. In sports this afternoon, the trainer of euthanized filly Eight Bells wants to dispel rumors the horse may have been on steroids. Larry Jones has ordered drug testing to be part of the autopsy on the Kentucky Derby runner-up. The horse was put down after breaking both front ankles on Saturday. Serena Williams won her 16th straight match today, defeating Francesca Schiavone 6-2, 6-3 in the second round of the German Open. The sixth-ranked Williams has won four straight WTA events and hasn't lost since the quarterfinals of the Australian Open. Lakers star Kobe Bryant is expected to be named the NBA's MVP today. Neither the league nor the team will confirm it, but a news conference is scheduled for today at a Los Angeles hotel to make what the league is calling an NBA awards announcement. Bryant is expected to receive the trophy tomorrow night from Commissioner David Stern before the Lakers face the Utah Jazz in Game 2 of their best-of-seven second-round playoff series. The Lakers won the opener 109-98 on Sunday. The Celtics are coming off a short turnaround headed into tonight's opening game of their NBA conference semifinal versus the visiting Cleveland Cavaliers. Top-seeded Boston was taken to the seven-game limit in the first round by a young Atlanta team that entered postseason play with the worst record of any playoff team. That series ended with Sunday's emphatic 99-65 beatdown of the upstart Hawks. On the other hand, the Cavs have been off since Friday when they completed a six-game series victory with a 105-88 win over the Washington Wizards. The White Sox will be trying to pull out of a nosedive when they host Minnesota on tonight's full Major League schedule. Chicago has lost six straight, while the Twins have ridden a five-game winning streak to the top of the American League Central, two games better than the second-place Sox. Chicago's Carlos Zambrano and Cincinnati's Aaron Harang square off today as the NL Central rivals will continue their three-game series tonight at Great American Ballpark. The Cubs have dropped 8 of 11 since opening the year 15-6 to match their best 21-game start since 1907. And pitcher Braden Looper will look to make his third straight impressive start for the first-place St. Louis Cardinals when they continue a three-game series with the struggling Colorado Rockies. St. Louis beat Colorado 6-5 yesterday. That's a look at sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Guido's in downtown Champaign, with casual dining for lunch, dinner, or late-night get-togethers. Along with TVs for watching the game, Guido's offers outside patio seating and a newly remodeled basement for private parties.
Take a look across America, and you can find more than 1.5 million adopted children under the age of 18. That number grows by more than 100,000 every year. How is emotional health affected by adoption? Michelle Trudeau reports that researchers now have an answer.
People have wondered for a long time whether children who were adopted in infancy are at increased risk for psychological problems. Now, in the first study of its kind, research psychologist Margaret Keyes actually tested the psychological well-being of adopted teenagers.
We've assembled a sample of 692 adopted adolescents, all of whom had been adopted prior to 2 years of age.
In fact, the average child in this study went to live with their new family at only 4 months of age. When Keyes tested them, they were around 15 years old. They were given in-depth psychological interviews checking for depression, anxiety, ADHD, and something called oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD.
These are kids who argue with their parents, who refuse to follow through on chores, maybe argue with their teachers, blame other people for their own mistakes.
More than just a negative teenager, ODD is persistent hostility and disobedience. For comparison, Keyes gave the same extensive psychological workup to a group of teenagers raised by their biological parents. The results are published this month in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine.
We found that most of the adolescents, adopted and non-adopted, were psychologically healthy. Overwhelmingly psychologically healthy.
That being said, Keyes did find what she calls an adoption effect.
There's a slightly increased risk for the adopted kids, especially ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder.
This risk was doubled in the adopted teenagers. Keyes explains.
So if you look at something like ADHD, for the non-adopted kids, about 7 out of every 100 had a diagnosis of ADHD. For the adopted kids, it's more like 14 or 15 out of every 100.
And similarly for oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, nearly a doubling of the risk. But there was no increased risk among adopted teenagers for depression or anxiety or for a form of serious delinquency that involves aggression, truancy, vandalism, and the like. David Brodzinski is professor emeritus from Rutgers University, a leader in the field of adoption research. He's not surprised that some psychological problems were doubled in a group of adopted children.
Many of the serious problems associated with adoption have less to do with adoption per se than with what happens before adoption.
Such as genetic factors, the health of the biological parents, possible exposure to alcohol or drugs in utero. All these before factors impact the later mental health of a child. Brodzinski's own research finds that adopting parents are a special breed, highly motivated, better educated, better off financially than non-adopting parents. And now Margaret Keyes adds to this list, adopting parents were also more likely to get help from mental health professionals for their adopted child when behavioral problems arose. There's one more provocative finding from this study. Adopted children born in another country, most in this study came from South Korea, had slightly less ADHD than adopted children born in the United States. It's not clear why this may be the case. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, some Mexican-made goods are being delivered throughout the United States on Mexican-owned trucks. That's saving consumers money, but U.S. truckers say it's a bad idea. A PRI correspondent is on the Texas border with Mexico's trucks. We'll hear that story in the day's news coming up on The World. You can hear the program this afternoon at 3 o'clock Central Time. Compact fluorescent light bulbs are one of those classic environmental dilemmas. They're very efficient and they use as little as 1/4 of the energy as a traditional light bulb. But there's a twist. They have a small amount of the toxic chemical mercury in them. Rebecca Williams takes a look at what to do if a light bulb breaks in your home.
You can't get around it. Right now, there has to be mercury in compact fluorescent lamps, or what the experts call CFLs. The bulbs can't produce light without it, but mercury is toxic. It can cause brain damage and developmental problems in fetuses and young children, and that worries people. The good news is, the amount of mercury in compact fluorescents is very small. On average, there are about 5 milligrams of mercury in a CFL. That's about what would fit on the tip of a ballpoint pen. Jeff Kirchmerick is an expert on household hazardous waste.
There's 100 times more mercury in a thermometer than one CFL.
Kirchmerick says there's absolutely no reason to panic if a bulb breaks in your house. You just need to be careful cleaning it up. So let's have the experts walk us through it. First, we're going to have to smash a light bulb.
Well, we have a compact fluorescent light bulb here, and what we're going to do is break it and then bring over our methylmercury vapor gas detector to show what exactly the exposure issue is with a broken CFL.
Okay, here we go. And kids, don't try this at home.
And this is what we use to identify hot spots and mercury spills. And Dan's going to wand over it.
Dan is Dan Moody. He's the guy with the vapor detector.
Right now we're showing about 936 nanograms. We like to see below 300 to 400 nanograms for mercury in the environment, particularly at a residential type setting or anywhere children would be spending time.
Very quickly, the readings dropped to 304 nanograms. That's because we've got the door open and the room is vented. Moody says that level's not something to worry about for your average adult. The problem is, the mercury can linger in your house if you don't clean it up the right way. Most importantly, the experts say never, ever use a vacuum. Vacuums can spread mercury vapor through your house. Deb Stoller is a researcher with the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. She recently tested the best ways to clean up broken fluorescent bulbs. So, when you break a bulb,
make sure that your pets and children and other extraneous people are out of the room. Open a window and then leave the room yourself for a little while.
Wait about 15 minutes to let the room air out before you clean up the broken bulb.
So when you go back in the room, then I would recommend having some stiff paper, like index cards or even just a deck of cards, to pick up the bigger pieces.
Here's where good old duct tape comes in. You can use it to get the last little shards of glass off the floor. Then put all of your materials into a glass jar with a lid, seal it up, and take it out of the house. Although some states don't allow it, in most states, it is legal to throw the broken light bulbs in the trash. And when you go to the store to replace those light bulbs, you do have some choices. Alicia Culver is with the National Green Lighting Campaign. She says manufacturers are trying to find alternatives to mercury in fluorescent bulbs. But for now, the best you can do is try to buy ones with lower mercury levels.
We're also encouraging consumers not just to buy the cheapest CFL, but to look for ones that are Energy Star rated. And Energy Star is starting to put a mercury limit on the light bulbs that they will qualify and rate.
So the bottom line, Culver says compact fluorescents are still the best light bulbs to buy. Because they're so much more efficient, compact fluorescents cut back on electricity use. And that reduces demand on coal-burning power plants, by far the biggest source of mercury we're adding to our world. For The Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about The Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Fans of Project Runway have to wait until the new season begins this summer to get their fix of fashion designers in heated competition. But seniors at the Savannah College of Art and Design are living out their own private version of the popular reality show. 97 students of fashion are scrambling to finish their collections before they graduate. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Project Runway has Tim Gunn to guide its fashionistas. The Savannah College of Art and Design has Anthony S. Miller to guide its undergraduates.
Should I interface it?
No.
Should I make it wider?
A little bit.
A little bit wider? Like
Miller chairs the fashion and accessories department, although he says today it's more like the drama department.
Today is a Senior Collection 3-Day, which is the finalization of garments.
12 to 15 garments, all illustrating a look.
2 weeks to the wire, and the tensions are high.
The handful of students stitching, pinning, and seaming away in a sunny white brick workroom seem focused more than stressed.
Can you hand me my scissors, please?
So here we are in a senior room. I'm very sensitive to them right now because there's food in here. And ordinarily I'd be like, get it out. Food and fabric don't go together.
Senior Andrea McLeod is working on a flowing silver tunic with a saucily draped neckline. Her collection was inspired by the painting The Birth of Venus.
It's nice. Wow. You really want to do an angle like that. This is what, a four-ply?
Yeah.
Silk crepe?
Mm-hmm. Silk, crepe, boring, thought senior Jessica Osterman. She's smoothing out a colorful dress made of something petroleum-based.
It's a plastic Mexican floral tablecloth. It's $5 a yard. I wanted to make it $500.
Osterman's collection is mod, flashy, and expensive-looking. It was inspired by the cover of the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Oh my gosh, the colors, the prints, everything.
The cheap oilcloth is now resplendently embellished with crystals. At first, fashion chair Anthony Miller had his suspicions about Osterman's idea and her fabric of choice.
We talked about it, and then she showed me this amazing swatch.
And now you love it.
That wasn't the only student concept that sounded terrible to Miller. Hattie Saltonstall produced a collection inspired by cancer.
Initially, when she presented it, I thought, And it really turned out to be beautiful. When I turn it and I see that, that just jumps out at you.
Yeah.
It's insane.
This darkly gleaming formal gown doesn't look especially cancerous, except for the bumps that seem to grow in its midnight blue folds and clustering around its bodice. The collection came about when Hattie Saltonstall's mother was diagnosed with cancer, and her godmother died from it during this, her senior year.
I was trying to figure out a way to get myself through it. And I wanted to show somebody that you can take something that's so ugly, that has no rules, that does whatever it wants, and that you can still make it beautiful if you look hard enough for it.
They're showstoppers, says the chair of the fashion department at the Savannah College of Art and Design. He says he can't wait to show this collection to designer John Colliano when he visits the school later this month. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Can't get enough of Vivaldi? Missing one of Kiss's albums? Find them among the thousands of records, CDs, videos, DVDs at this year's vintage vinyl sale for WILL's Illinois Radio Reader, Saturday, May 17th at Lincoln Square Village, Urbana. The sale begins at 8 a.m. with a $5 entrance fee, free admittance after 11 a.m., and the half-price sale begins at 4 p.m.
Earth and Sky.
I'm Deborah Bird. For several years now, we've heard the story about Earth's becoming a more urban world. In 2008...
The UN, who estimates these things and does a rather detailed job of it, will in fact say that over half of world population is now urban.
That's Carl Hobb of the Population Reference Bureau in Washington, D.C. He talked about what urban means.
I think people should not get the impression that half of world population is living in places like Rio de Janeiro or New York. That's not at all true. A city of 5,000 or more in India, whose labor force is not wholly engaged in agriculture, is considered urban. If you've ever been to a town of 5,000 in India, you would not really think of that as being terribly urban.
He said the definition urban was first used to identify a non-agricultural population.
When you think about the U.S. at the time of its founding, we were essentially a nation of farmers. So we came to define the non-agricultural population, and we use that word urban. A much smaller share of people are in fact living in the Shanghais and the Bombays and the New Yorks of this world. However, it's not insignificant that people have moved into towns as opposed to being living off the land. It's still a sociological benchmark for sure.
We have more with demographer Carl Hobb of the Population Reference Bureau at our website. This is Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering continental breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated and newly remodeled. Second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Sunday afternoon at 2 a.m. 580 will broadcast the University of Illinois' 136th commencement ceremonies live. This year's keynote speaker is Illinois alumnus and chairman and owner of the Harlem Globetrotters, Manny Jackson. Because of this special broadcast, the Tavis Smiley Show will not be heard. That's the University of Illinois commencement ceremonies, Sunday afternoon at 2, here on WILL Urbana and online at will.illinois.edu. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Let's take a look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana. Mike Sola says tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, scattered showers and thunderstorms in Illinois, isolated areas of rain in Indiana, lows ranging from 54 in eastern Indiana to 62 in southern Indiana. Tomorrow, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms with locally heavy rainfall, highs ranging from 66 in far northwestern Illinois to near 80 in southern Indiana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, becoming mostly cloudy, mild, showers and thunderstorms possible, mainly after midnight, the low 58. The outlook for tomorrow, mostly cloudy.
cloudy and breezy with a few showers and thunderstorms. The high 73. The wind tomorrow from the southwest at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Up next, it's The World from PRI. Stay tuned.